I'm speaking with Mika Sifri, who is the author of the new book, WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency. He is the co-founder and editor of the Personal Democracy Forum, and his other books include Is That a Politician in Your Pocket?, Spoiling for a Fight, Third Party Politics in America, The Iraq War Reader, and The Gulf War Reader. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mika Sifri.
Great to be here, Ian.
And I guess the latest news, just to touch on the fate of Julian Assange, just last week, the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, was told by a judge in London that he will be extradited to Sweden to answer accusations of rape and sexual assault. But, of course, there's a lengthy legal battle ahead. What's your sense on where this, how long this is going to take and where this is heading?
Well, I'm not an expert on treaties of extradition and nor on the laws of Sweden pertaining to sexual assault or harassment. So my sense is it's going to drag out for a while, which is really unfortunate. And that my personal view, having gotten to know Julian a bit, he's spoken at two Personal Democracy Forum conferences, one in Europe 2 years ago, the last one in June. He was supposed to come and join Daniel Ellsberg on stage. They had never met in person before, and at the last minute he pulled out because he had been warned it would not be safe to come to the U.S. My personal views of him are complicated. I think he is courageous. He has done something with great audacity and drive that many lesser people would not have dared to do. I also think he has a messy personal life, and he has not really been accountable to his staff and the people who have worked closely with him. Many of the folks who worked on editing and releasing the collateral murder video have since distanced themselves from WikiLeaks or gone off to start new organizations. And their complaint is that Julian is running WikiLeaks in too autocratic a manner, that he's become a huge bottleneck. And indeed, it is. We now know that many of the WikiLeaks internal operations are in a mess as a result of all these splits and his leadership style, and that there's information that they have that is not being released as a result because of that bottleneck. So, if it were up to me, I'd say just get it over with. Get your, deal with your personal life. Hopefully, you can get justice in Sweden. And then get back to trying to do the more important stuff that you set out to do in the first place. But it's painful to see how this is going to get dragged out, and I don't think it's in anyone's interest.
But, of course, Mika Sifri, there's a huge difference between the messenger and the message.
Mm-hmm.
And the message here is, I think, profound in how much it has changed global politics. The relationship between the individual and the state has been irrevocably changed by social media, and of course WikiLeaks are a huge part of that. We're talking about the intersection between politics and the internet, and between power and truth, access, transparency, and democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about some huge issues here.
For sure, and I actually think, look, the reason I wrote this book was not to do one more tell-all of the inside story at WikiLeaks. That other people are writing that book, including Julian himself is writing a book, and the various journalists who have played a more intimate role in the revelations of the last year are all writing their books. I've been involved with the transparency movement in the United States and to some degree internationally for 5, 6, 7 years. I've helped set up the Sunlight Foundation 5 years ago, which has become one of the leading nonprofits that works to use technology and social media to shine more light on the inner workings of Washington. And through that work, I've come to know a lot of people around the world who are basically taking matters into their own hands and saying, if governments and corporations won't open up, we will open them up. So I want people to understand that WikiLeaks is absolutely an important piece in the transparency movement, but it may not be the best model. And that this larger phenomenon of people liberating information and putting it out in public view where it is unstoppable is the more important thing we have to defend and try and expand. And that it's vital that we not turn this into a cult of personality around Julian Assange or vilification around him. He is one symptom of a much larger trend. And that trend is very, very important. It's the silver lining in the otherwise dark clouds of our times, I think. There are a lot of very distressing trends that we're facing, and the one good one, the one that I've certainly spent a lot of time working on is this idea that more people are becoming empowered through this dispersion of connection technologies to find out and spread the truth. And that means challenging opaque and secretive institutions and forcing them to open up and be more accountable. And it's messy, and it's not proceeding, in an even path. There are fits and spurts. I do think WikiLeaks has really shown a lot of people a way forward, and that may be the most important thing, this idea of a transnational entity that sits on no one country's servers and that is supported by volunteers all over the world as a independent platform for getting information out from whistleblowers. That genie is out of the bottle now. And if Julian Assange ends up in jail and WikiLeaks ends up shut down, that larger phenomenon of transnational information sharing is not going to go away.
Again, I'm speaking with Mika Sifri, author of the new book, WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency. And, of course, here at KPFK in Los Angeles, we are a part of the alternative media in the United States in as much as we're independent, non-corporate, independent entirely upon our sustenance from our listeners. And, of course, we've been offering up in the last fund drive a thumb drive with all of the WikiLeaks, the way that they've laid it out, their kind of index, and tried to do as much as to disseminate that. And we're very grateful to you that we can offer up your books, WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency, to continue that work. Give us a sense to our audience, Mika, if you can, of why you did this book and how you feel this message needs to get out.
Sure. Well, there are two really things that that spurred this book into existence, and I have to say it was written in a rush between the end of December and the end of January, though it draws on writing and work that I've been doing since 2004, when I first wrote an article for The Nation about the rise of open source politics and the work that we do with Personal Democracy Forum in bringing together the activists, the hackers, and the hacks who are aware that information technology, connection technologies are enabling a whole new way of doing things, and that those changes are going to hit politics and government and civil society in ways that could make things more open and transparent and accountable. So I set out to do this book as a way of showing the larger picture, that we are now in an age, maybe 5-6 years in, where activism is taking many new forms, but at the bottom line, it's more social. It's you don't need permission in the old ways, whether it's from, an authority or, the head of an organization. You can just go out and launch something yourself now. You can be a pamphleteer. You can be a fundraiser, an organizer, and reach hundreds or thousands of people very quickly if your message is compelling. That is a sea change in, the world of political organizing from the days when you had to stuff envelopes and lick stamps and, think how easy it is now. The other big change that I document in the book is something that has been happening more from the technology sector, but it is now becoming so commonplace that people aren't even sensitive to it, which is how information itself has become more interactive. Websites talking to other websites. You've heard the term mashup, I'm sure, by now. But mashups like taking, Craigslist list of apartments and mapping it onto a Google map so you can see, where the apartments you're looking for may be all in relation to each other. That's only 6 years old, the ability to do that kind of thing. And so what we're seeing people do now with political information is things like try to map what somebody's campaign contributions to a congressman, how those may relate to the timing of votes or the time of fundraisers. Recently, there, thanks to the work that Sunlight did tracking political fundraisers, the Office of Congressional Ethics opened an investigation into several members of Congress who were holding fundraisers with people from the banking industry at precisely the time that they were voting on the financial reform legislation. We're slowly prying open the way power works in Washington. And what the new leverage we have is these technological tools, data itself being more interactive, and then the social web, the ability for us to share in real time what we know, to fact check, to call BS on people in real time. These are all new, very, very powerful skills. If they didn't exist, Alberto Gonzalez might still be Bush's attorney general. You know, he was brought down by bloggers asking their readers to help them investigate this seemingly unconnected pattern of U.S. attorneys being fired for political reasons. That's a great example of how new media and the social web can come together to challenge power. And so I wrote WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency not to really be that much about WikiLeaks as about this larger phenomenon of us acting together, learning how to knit together as these sort of new powerful networks for transparency and for truth. And it's not just in the U.S., by the way. This is the other thing that's very exciting. It is international. And you can see in the most recent protests happening in the Middle East, but you can see it in all kinds of movements for government transparency from India, Brazil, Croatia. And so I try to document a lot of those examples, too, for people to see that this is really part of a much larger, very exciting trend.
Let me remind the audience again, if I may. I'm speaking with Mika Sifford, the author of the new book, WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency. He's also the co-founder and editor of the Personal Democracy Forum. And, of course, amusingly enough, just this week, Mika, President Bush canceled an appearance because he was being paid a considerable sum to appear there. And turned out that Julian Assange was also going to join the conference by video. So this war between the United States and Assange goes on. But one of the things that I find amusing about, and we talked a while back with Charlie Peters, a veteran reporter in Washington, who sort of jokingly said, the great contribution WikiLeaks has made to the State Department is that they've finally somebody's reading these diplomats' cables, and in effect, he didn't understand why the U.S. government was so upset that it cast them in a pretty good light, and that's certainly the case when it comes to the WikiLeaks in Tunisia. That gave the rebels or the young students there rising up against that kleptocracy a lot of validation that others in the world, including the United States, knew about these crooks that have been sitting on them for 40 years.
Yeah, I've heard the argument made that, in fact, this shows U.S. diplomacy in a positive light. And there's no question that a lot of people in the Foreign Service are hardworking, dedicated people who, a great deal of what they do is unsung, valuable. They're trying to help, in many cases, with economic development, with education, with some of the more mundane things you wish the United States did more of. I think it's really a mistake, and it's part of what the government is trying to do right now is to convince people that nothing really significant happened here. It's a contradictory message, right? there's no news in these cables. On the other hand, they gravely damaged the United States security, and Julian Assange should be, put in jail or worse. In fact, the cables, I think, show there are a lot of important revelations, some of which were covered, like the fact that Hillary Clinton ordered spying on the diplomats at the UN, or that the Pentagon lied about keeping track of the body count in Iraq, and that it, in fact, something like 15,000 more people than had been estimated previously. We had documentation for their deaths, or that we were conducting a secret war in Yemen with the connivance of the president of that country. The Tunisia cables, I mean, it's worth looking at a little more closely. It's true that the ambassador described quite eloquently and in somewhat outraged terms the corruption of the government, but that cable did not prevent the United States from continuing to send foreign aid to Tunisia. It didn't force a reevaluation of policy. The same with cables about corruption in other parts of the world.
Well, I guess that, Mika, that indicates that nobody reads these cables, right?
Well, or that they're read and read in a very cynical way. Right. I have been on a couple of panels recently with top editors or reporters from the New York Times who want us to think that they've been incredibly brave in printing, when working with WikiLeaks and printing these stories. And it's true, in the current climate in the United States, I'm glad the New York Times has shown some backbone in ignoring what the State Department and others were saying about how gravely they might damage American security. But the Times itself is an imperfect vessel for sifting the importance of these cables. It clearly often bends in the direction of the government's preferences and has admitted numerous times that it has been mistaken in listening to the government. The James Risen story about the warrantless wiretapping was held for a year at the behest of the Bush administration, and Bill Keller, the same guy who's now, sort of doing a victory lap about publishing these WikiLeaks stories, really hasn't explained or admitted that mistake.
Well, Congresswoman Jane Harman out here in Los Angeles, who was caught in an NSA wiretap talking to an Israeli spy, she was the one that the White House blackmailed, and Gonzalez sent her to the New York Times to make the case because they knew that the New York Times wouldn't listen to the White House, but they would to a Democratic congressman.
Yeah, the Times, I think, needs to do some more internal soul-searching. And even now, they have admitted when they got they have the entire archive, by the way. People may not realize that the 250,000 cables that were leaked to WikiLeaks are now also fully in the hands of the New York Times as well as the Guardian and maybe some of the other early collaborators, we don't know. And the Times has admitted that they don't have the resources to read all 250,000 of them, that what they've done in their reporting is search on keywords and, been enterprising to the degree that they can think up, look for patterns. But they missed the meaning of the Tunisia cable. They've admitted that it wasn't until after things started to explode in Tunisia that they realized the importance of those cables. And right now, they're using the archive as this kind of private treasure trove that they tap into as news stories develop. And I've seen it's clear that they don't fully understand all the importance of what may be buried in what has yet to be released. Only about 4,000 or so cables have actually been released in full. And so one has to ask, is there a way, without unnecessarily exposing people to potential harm, is there a way to get the rest of the archive out or to get more experts in to help figure out what else needs to be out? We clearly have an epidemic of secrecy in the United States. There were 2 million people with access to the same network that Bradley Manning allegedly was tapping into, and there are millions of secrets, millions of new classification events happen every year. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, back when he was in the Senate 14 years ago, tried valiantly to push for a reduction in classification and for a massive sort of paradigm shift, arguing that actually the more we classify, the less we know. The more people think that something should only be paid attention to because it's classified. And you're right, Ian. In many cases, they're not even paying attention to some of this stuff. That open information sharing in the world today makes a lot more sense than this incredibly closed space. And that's not to say that there isn't a need for discretion and a need for confidentiality. And to be sure, if you're trying to negotiate or barter a deal between adversaries, some of that has to be done in private. I'm not saying let it all hang out constantly, but we have far too much secrecy, and it's abused. It's used mostly to hide embarrassments or to burnish somebody's reputation. The government leaks all the time. It's just when it does it in ways that are meant to make somebody look good rather than really help the public understand what's going on.
Well, Mika Sifri, again, the author of the new book, WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency, the co-founder and editor of the Personal Democracy Forum. I guess this is the revolution that's happened. I don't know that it can be sustained, that there's any systematic way that we can find to bring the citizen up to date with what people that they, who are on the taxpayer's dime, employees of the people who have reserved to themselves the right to decide what people should know and what they shouldn't know. And it is, of course, as you mentioned, a vast cult of secrecy.
It's starting to change. Let me give a more mundane example, okay? Because, there's the national security state, which is like the hardcore, okay? And that will be the hardest, I think, to open up. But as I document in my book, 6 years ago, there was an effort in Chicago to put the city's data online so that people could see, when all kinds of service requests come in, fix a pothole, fix a broken street lamp and so on. The city collects that data, and the idea was to show it all on a website and so that people could track how well the city was doing its job. The site was built. It had the mayor's support. It was called ChicagoWorksForYou.com. And at the last stage, it had to be approved by all the city aldermen. And they took one look at it and said, this is great stuff, but you're not going to put it out in public. We don't want the public to know about, the 10% of potholes that aren't being filled fast enough. They completely clamped down. And that is a behavior of the past. The good news is that cities like Chicago and many, many others, San Francisco, Seattle, Washington, D.C., New York, you name it, we have a mass movement now of cities opening up all this public data and making it easier for people to see what's being done, whether their tax dollars are being spent well, whether things can be fixed more efficiently or done in new ways. And they're even enabling developers, coders, to build third-party applications on top of all of this data. And so we're seeing, and part of this is just because the technology makes it possible. Part of it is because cities need to save money, and this is a way for them to tap into the civic surplus that's available of people who want to volunteer and make their cities work better. But it's a change in how politicians think about information. Instead of monopolizing it, they're sharing it. And it's true, sharing information about potholes is very different than sharing information about, predator drones. Sure. But it's a crack. And I'm a congenital optimist. I think we are seeing the beginning of a much bigger trend, which will shift over the next generation as new people come into government and say, look, this is just a better way of doing things. So you're right. It's not exactly clear how we expand it and keep it going, but the broad trend is towards more participation and more openness. And when people are not transparent, they're now faced with a question of trust. What are you hiding from us? Why are you hiding from us? Even the Federal Reserve now has been forced to open up its books. And that's as part of the reaction to, you know, the great scandals of Wall Street over the last few years. So I would prefer to see this as the beginning of a much bigger change, and one that we all can participate in, each in our own way, in helping open up the government and make it more responsive to us.
Well, just finally, Mika Sifri, my feeling is that you could really make the case that the alternative media, like WikiLeaks, and I think in particular, for example, the prank phone call of the governor in Wisconsin, I learned more from that phone call than all of the news coverage, because you really got it. You really understood this guy was explaining to who he thought was his political patron, his strategy in Wisconsin, and the right wing Republican Tea Party's national strategy to go after public service unions and defund the Democratic Party. And it was really quite chilling, and of course somewhat entertaining at the same time. And I feel that there's an alternative. There's two universes here. There's the universe of the traditional press, and this other kind of chaotic one that really is the one that really feeds the zeitgeist.
And we haven't even mentioned what Anonymous is doing, right? So we're beginning to see this loose network of civic hackers and troublemakers who have done all, I mean, they're not entirely a savory bunch. Sometimes the things they do online are quite racist and sexist, but they sprung into action to go after some of the companies that had kicked WikiLeaks off their servers, like Amazon or PayPal. And more recently, in response to an effort by a security firm called H.B. Gary, which was shopping a proposal to the Bank of America to attack WikiLeaks and its supporters like Glenn Greenwald, Anonymous hacked H.B. Gary's emails and have posted something like 70,000, 80,000 unexpurgated company emails on the web, which, too, are showing something about how very powerful institutions like the Chamber of Commerce, Hunton and Williams, a very important law firm in Washington, how they're actually operating. This is citizen-driven transparency. I think it absolutely is on or crossing an ethical line. I think posting people's personal emails raises very troubling issues of privacy. I'm not sure that it was necessary to do that, but Anonymous plays by its own rules, and it is those are rules that the technological infrastructure that we now have make possible. For us in the open information movement, the key issue here is how do we ensure that this platform, the Internet, which is enabling all this kind of free speech and activism, stays open? And it isn't just about net neutrality, which is just one piece of the puzzle. We could have the best net neutrality rules, and a company like Amazon can quite arbitrarily kick somebody off their servers by, you know, picking some phrase out of their terms of service that give them complete latitude to do that. The same is true for Facebook, which has turned into a great platform for people to organize in the Middle East, and at the same time, it's a very precarious one because Facebook requires you to use your real name, and if you use your real name in a police state, you're just giving them a map to who to arrest. So I think there's no question that there's more dynamism and power that we're beginning to see come up from below in exposing the ways of the powerful. And I totally agree with you that prank call of Governor Walker is a great example of how citizens are going to start taking more actions on their own that have the effect of exposing how things really work.
Well, just in the last few seconds then, Mika Sifri, remind us why we should get your book.
Well, I think, you know, I wrote WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency because I really wanted to give people a kind of primer to this movement. I wanted to situate WikiLeaks in the larger trend, and also to give people a sense of what are some of the main institutions and projects both in the U.S. and outside where they can get involved. To also understand some of the principles behind how efforts to open up government and share information really work. There's still a lot of information silos on the left and in public interest work in general. You have lots of organizations that are hoarding information rather than sharing it themselves. And so we need to apply the same approach that we expect others to take to our own work, because it'll make it stronger. And so I really wanted to give people if you're already in this work, you may find the book somewhat familiar, or a little bit of a refresher perhaps. But if you're new and find what is bubbling up to be exciting and maybe a little confusing, hopefully my book can give you a helpful guide. And look, the bottom line is, as I say in the book, an old way of doing things is dying. A new way is being born, and we need more midwives. We need more people to come in and help. So I really hope that I'm providing some handholds and some places for activists to engage more effectively.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us here today on Background Briefing, Mika Sifri.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mika Sifri, who is the author of the new book, WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency. He is the co-founder and editor of the Personal Democracy Forum, and his other books include Is That a Politician in Your Pocket?, Spoiling for a Fight, Third Party Politics in America, The Iraq War Reader, and The Gulf War Reader.